Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This edition of Nature Bats Last comes live from the Mud Hut in New Mexico. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Thanks to Pauline Schneider for being our host when called upon and her analysis of the shows for the last few months. This week's show, we have three Breaking Hopian segments, a climate change update, and our guest, Derek Jensen. And we start off with Breaking Hopium, Forrest Palmer.
Natural gas is invisible and odorless. In order for people to not be accidentally killed due to its presence in the atmosphere, be it through inhalation or inadvertent combustion by way of lighting a match or starting a fire, an odorant is added to this substance to alert people of its presence. This additive is why natural gas has a smell comparable to rotten eggs. Of course, what makes natural gas most dangerous is that people don't have the ability to know if it is permeating their bodies or the surrounding area. You can't see it, smell it, taste it, touch it, or hear it. Therefore, the inability to discern if the substance is in your vicinity is the difference between life and certain death. In comparing natural gas and the difference between life and death being an acknowledgement by the dominant culture as to its danger, there's another substance that is even more insidious, unacknowledged as to its true peril. This would be carbon. In the news recently, we learned that the atmosphere on Earth read 400 parts per million in carbon dioxide for 1 month straight in March 2015. As with almost everything in life, this didn't occur instantaneously. The first recording of 400 parts per million happened in May 2012 at an Arctic monitoring station. Since that time, this increase to 400 parts per million has been measured in Hawaii and has now culminated in an entire month of being above 400 parts per million, where this is quickly becoming the new normal. Although this isn't a blip on the general population's radar regarding its severity, we are in essence in the process of inhaling a symbolic natural gas without being cognizant of the fact we are doing it, or at least the danger in doing so. The reason we aren't cognizant is because of our lack of appreciation for much that doesn't have a human death toll. More times often than not, this is only concerning the possibility of our deaths or those close to us, I am sad to say. With natural gas, there is evidence on many occasions of this ominous substance killing countless people in the past, which is why the precaution is taken of adding an odorant to it today. Therefore, regarding carbon, if we were able to go through the actual rise of carbon in the atmosphere and then see the destructive capability of this and catastrophic human death tolls, not once, but a few times, then it will finally get through our seemingly thick skulls that this will kill us. Hence, is the need for visual, empirical evidence that is the major impediment to people realizing the dangerous circumstances we are in currently. Or to be graphic, there are no blood in the streets. Yet. The sad part is that this will almost certainly be a one-time experiment with us as guinea pigs. All we can hope for is that a species may replace us in another million years or so that learns from the evidence of our demise. Because what we are essentially doing as a culture is mass suicide. Metaphorically speaking, we have been told that the gas leaving a pipe is going to kill us, and not only have we not tried to stop the leak or get away from it to show any signs of self-preservation, we have instead put our entire mouth around the pipe to inhale as much of this toxic substance as possible. It seems as if drill, baby, drill will be our suicide note. Hence, it is one little chemical element with nothing of the tangible properties we equate with death that is causing our downfall, carbon. The only question is, will it be an explosion of epic proportions that finally ends this dance with unreality, or will we just go silently into the night, drifting off into an eternal slumber. Time will tell. But the one thing is for certain, we can't put the proverbial genie back in the bottle or the gas back in the ground.
Thank you, Forrest Palmer. Corey Morningstar joins us for a second helping of Breaking Hopium.
Avaaz co-founder Jeremy Hymans of Purpose, Inc., Avaaz's for-profit public relations arm, explained how his firm would systematically organize people around a movement that encapsulated the green economy. This was crucial because, as Hymans pointed out, the green economy was in a rut. In order to achieve the stated goal, Hymans was clear on the critical strategy. They would kill green in order to save it. Kill green marketing, including the key term, green economy, in order to push forward the green economy without saying so. Jump forward to the new economy, a necessary rebranding to achieve the stated goal to, quote, systematically organize people around a movement that encapsulated the green economy mainstream, unquote. The oligarchs are most grateful to the army that comprises the nonprofit industrial complex. Without this army, who would cloud the dynamics at a juncture where clarity is so essential? For society's collective willingness and almost disturbing eagerness to be led astray creates a ripe atmosphere for the very oligarchs, false prophets, and corporate entities, those who have brought us to the ecological precipice, to be repackaged as environmentally conscious saviors. To build acquiescence and even demand for sustainable capitalism and the initial implementation of ecosystem services valuation accounting by 2020, both pathologies are simply embedded into the new economy ideology without saying as much. They'll expand capital markets and commence the implementation of payments for ecosystem services. They just won't talk about it, and they won't say that they're doing it. What is marketed to the public as the new economy under a multitude of campaigns saturated in holistic language is fully understood by the nonprofit industrial complex and the world's most powerful institutions, media, and elites as capitalism not only rebranded and protected, but propelled. Consider that while the terms ecosystem services, new economy, next system, natural capital, etc., saturate the public sphere via the nonprofit industrial complex and media, the most critical aspect of the scheme, that of payments for, is rarely, if ever, mentioned. Welcome to the greatest cywar of the 21st century, a hegemonic, global, concerted effort, unparalleled in scale and magnitude.
What a perfect introduction for today's guest. Thank you, Corey Morningstar. We are honored to interview Derek Jensen this week. Jensen has been hailed as the poet philosopher of the ecological movement by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! His scholarly efforts have produced In-Game, The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, and nearly two dozen other books. He was named one of Utney Reader's 50 Visionaries Who Are Changing Your World and was awarded the grand prize in the Eric Hoffer Award Competition for Independent Books in 2008 for his book, Thought to Exist in the Wild. Jensen has written for Orion, Audubon, and The Sun magazine, among many other media outlets. In addition, he hosts Resistance Radio on this station every Sunday evening. Welcome to Nature Bats Blast on the Progressive Radio Network, Derek Jensen.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet, it's a pleasure. Your first two books, Listening to the Land and Railroads and Clear Cuts, were both published in 1995. That was 20 years ago. Much has changed during that time. Will you reflect on those changes for us?
Yeah, it's actually pretty easy. Things have gotten worse, and then worse, and then worse, and then worse. You know, back in the 90s, you could still see bees, and there were so many things that were still so much better back then. I don't know if you have if you experience this at all, but I know that when it's very difficult for me to read novels written in, say, the 19th century or to watch movies from the 1930s, because every time I do, even if the movie is set in the city, I think about how there were so many more salmon back then. And if I read a novel that's written in the 19th century, if I look at a picture from the American Civil War, I think that there were still passenger pigeons alive in the world then. And, you know, the oceans weren't getting hammered. And there wasn't dioxin in every mother's breast milk back in the 1930s because the explosion of pesticides and plastics hadn't happened yet. And so I think, and I'm not saying this in some sort of, oh, the good old days. I'm saying this in terms of the world was that much more, that much less wounded. And we can talk about, you know, whether things have particularly, you know, in what ways social movements might have gotten better. But, you know, the metric for everything for me is the health of the natural world. And every biological indicator that I know of is going in the wrong direction. And even you know, I've lived in the same place for 15 years in the Redwood Forest, Northern California, and just in 15 years, these tiny blue butterflies who used to be in the spring and summer there where it'd be hundreds near a puddle, and I think I've seen maybe three each year for the last couple of years, last 4 or 5 years, and the frogs would sing outside my window, and they would be so loud that you couldn't have a human conversation at night through this time of year. And now they're still there, but you can certainly have a human conversation, not so loud that they drown it out. And I was just talking to my mom yesterday about how there aren't very many bumblebees. You know, we've seen, used to, even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 6, 7 years ago, they were, the plants would be crawling with them. And I think I've seen 2 bumblebees this year, dragonflies, at this time of year and for the rest of the summer. The sky over this pond that's right next to my house is was filled with these beautiful, big, blue dragonflies. And I see about 2 or 3 per year. So it doesn't really matter. Or as I'm sure you know, sea lions are washing up on the shores of the Pacific Ocean. I mean, the Pacific beaches, in starving to death, and herring fisheries are collapsing. The smelt's collapsing. So I don't. When you ask what's changed in the meantime, things have gotten a lot worse. And so far as discourse, you know, I see, you know, my work. I see your work, which gives me great, I don't know what the right word is. It's certainly not optimism.
not hope.
That hope doesn't really work either. It gives me solace. I mean, it. That's one of the things that kills me about all this is that, you know, I don't think that either my or your work is particularly cognitively challenging in terms of just intellectual ability. It's not hard to see that when everything is falling apart, it's not really hard to see that everything is falling apart. I think so I derive something from the fact that you're out there doing your work and it's being received. But in terms of, I mean, it breaks my heart that there are so many people who can't see the pattern. I mean, they think that the problem is simply fossil fuels and oil and gas burning all the prehistoric energy is dreadfully destructive. But I guess the mechanisms of denial. I keep thinking about the Upton Sinclair line that it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it, or to take out the sexism and to make it more broad, it's hard to make a person understand something when their entitlement depends on them not understanding it. So I see that in effect everywhere. I mean, I don't know, I don't know if that's the answer you were expecting to that question, and if you want me to go a different direction, I can, but that's certainly my first response.
No, that's pretty much exactly what I expected. In my original question, I said, can you tell us what's changed, good and bad? And then I realized I can't think of anything of substance that has been made better in the last 20 years.
Derek, this is Mike Sliva. Guy and I meet every morning for coffee with a group of about 10 people, and last week we got a homework assignment, which was to actually answer that question. What are some good things that have happened in the last 20 years? And I think as a group, we came up with the taste of TV dinners was the only good thing. Not the ingredients, mind you, but the taste of the dinner. So,
hey, I can tell you one good thing that's happened in the last 25 years.
Yeah, yes.
This is for real. And it's, of course, on the larger scale, things are worse. But there are about 450 dead zones in the ocean, and they're getting to be more and more all the time. So on the large scale, this is bad. But there is one dead zone that has recovered. So that's one good thing. And the way this dead zone recovered is, I think, very important, which is it's in the Black Sea, or it was in the Black Sea. And the reason it recovered is because the Soviet Union collapsed, which made it no longer economically feasible to do agriculture along the coast of the Black Sea in that area. And so the ocean was able to come back right there because, what do you know, it stopped. I mean, they stopped the primary insult. And that's a really important thing. An image that I just wrote maybe a couple, 3 weeks ago for some piece or another that I've been thinking about a lot is I feel like so many environmentalists, and I want to be really clear, and I think you understand this too, we all understand this, that it's incredibly important for people to be doing their environmental work to stop whatever harm they can and to rehabilitate land wherever they can. All that stuff is incredibly important. But I keep picturing this person lying on a gurney and they are bleeding out. And there are all these doctors and nurses and everybody else who are putting on EMTs who are bandaging them up as quickly as they can. And that's incredibly important to keep them from bleeding out. But at the same time, there is someone else standing there who is continuing to stab the person. And what we need to do is, yes, we need to bandage the patient, but we also need to stop the stabbing.
Right. And we aren't stopping the stabbing in very many places. In fact, at this morning's coffee, somebody said, well, by the Iron Bridge, it's gotten a lot better in the last 20 years because they took the livestock out. And then somebody else pointed out that they put the livestock back in just a month or so ago. So the temporary gain there, the temporary win, has been overshadowed by keeping doing the same thing over and over. I think we're all teachers in this conversation. We all have taught in various places in our lives, and I think Mike has a question that gets at that common ground for us.
Yeah, I taught high school for about a dozen years, and I used, near the end of my teaching career, I used Endgame and some other books that you wrote, and because people would see me reading them during class, we had to start every class with about 20 minutes of silent reading, and people would be curious about what I was reading, and then inevitably we'd start discussing it, and it would become part of the lesson. But do you have any sort of advice for people that are in the profession that they could use your work and kind of use it within their curriculum somehow? Because it seems like civilization is the given always, but maybe some strategies?
What do you mean by strategy in terms of how to get it past administrators or how to get the students interested?
Probably a little of both. Because obviously the administration is something that is, if you're a high school teacher, that is the number one fear is your administrator walking in on you and calling on you. I didn't seem to have any problem getting the students interested. Because once you start talking about things that they can see with their own eyes and you talk about patterns and they can start to see the pattern, well, they're pretty engaged, at least that's been my experience. But, yeah, I guess maybe infiltrating curriculum.
Well, I don't. Probably, I know this is not a very useful answer, but probably the people to ask would be some of the teachers who have gotten by using it for a long time. There's this one teacher, used to be in Chicago, and now he's in Hong Kong, who was extraordinary. He used my texts in his high school class, and I would talk to his classes via Skype once every year or so. But one year we had to cancel because his entire class voted. He was in Chicago area. His entire class voted that instead of doing that day, that instead they were going to go up and protest against Scott Walker soon after he was elected in Wisconsin. And I've done some of his classes in Hong Kong too, and I don't know the vagaries of how you find a good administrator. You know, when I taught at Eastern Washington University, my supervisor was fabulous. I couldn't have asked for a better supervisor. Basically, as long as my students were learning, he didn't care what happened. You know, as long as you know, I was following basic moral rules and everything. And my experience with supervisors was actually very positive, and maybe because you have had, and I'm thinking you, Guy, having not good experiences, I mean, what could or would you have done differently to have been able to get more radical stuff into the class, or did you simply have to leave?
Well, that's a segue to an interesting story. I was just discussing a course I was to teach with my final department head at the University of Arizona. We chatted over morning coffee for an hour or so, and we agreed I would offer a new course in the School of Natural Resources. They've changed their name now, of course, because that's what administrators spend time and money on, is changing the names of their departments. So we agreed that I would use your 2006 book, Endgame. A few hours later, after she had a chance to investigate the book, she informed me by email that I would never use that book on her campus. Needless to say, I was never allowed to teach a course in that department again, which was my home department for 15 years at that point. But I did use Endgame for a course I taught through the Honors College, primarily because my department had threw down the gauntlet. And that year I was named Faculty Member of the Year of the Honors College. And the point of this story is that I know a few people with a message as polarizing as yours. It didn't work for me to try to teach at that institution any longer, and ultimately my message was too polarizing even for the institution. Actually, I don't know a few people with a message as polarizing as yours. I know one, and that's me. But
well,
I've been writing.
Go ahead. When you get done with this story, I want to ask you a question. Go ahead.
Sure. I've been writing publicly about abrupt climate change for only 3 years, which is a mere teardrop in an ocean relative to your own body of work and the time you spent developing it. You're referring to the demise of civilization. I'm referring to the demise of our species. Most people incorrectly equate the two. And so that leads me to a couple of questions, but you go ahead and ask yours first.
Well, I'm not sure. I know this is going to sound really naive, but I don't really understand. And that term polarizing is thrown out a lot about my work, and I honestly don't really understand it because it's just analysis. And if you don't like it, then that's okay. Do your own analysis. It's better. So I don't understand. I've never understood. I feel like kind of naive or something in that, you know, it's just, once again, it's simply analysis. I don't understand why it makes some people so angry. So this is not meant to, like, get you to give me strokes or something. I don't understand why it's polarizing. Like, once again, if somebody doesn't like it, they can do their own analysis that's better.
Well, I mean, I know you're asking this to Guy, but from what I've experienced, and you talk about patterns and people not seeing them, I think people, they attach their identity so much to the dominant culture and to civilization that to question it in any sort of way is a direct threat on actually who they are. Is the experience I've had in talking about these things and having people approach me after I talk about them and try and set me straight, so to speak. It seems to me that, in a sense, their identity feels threatened.
Well, thanks for saying that, and that actually does make sense because the central metaphor of all my work is death and rebirth. And so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And one of the things that says to me is we need to break our identification with the system and then rebuild our identification with the natural world and with our own communities that are the communities of willows and redwoods. And we need to break the loyalty to the system. And so, yeah, I think that what you say makes a lot of sense. But once again, it's like I'm attacking, and I understand that we identify with things, but I wish that people would understand that I am not attacking them personally. I am attacking the system, and they can choose to, they don't have to take it personally. When I say that civilization is not sustainable, I mean, they act like I've just told them that they're a horrible person. But actually, I've not. I've said, no, you're a wonderful, beautiful, amazing person, and the system is really awful.
Yeah, I've had the same experience, Derek, when I talk to, you know, former colleagues, and I criticize the institution of education, and they take it personally, and I'm not criticizing them. And I think it's because, and I had the same experience with police officers. If I'm critiquing law enforcement, I'm not critiquing you in particular, or I'm not, you know, critiquing you as a teacher. And I think part of it is because you think you're a teacher, and instead you're someone who teaches. Or you think you're a police officer, when instead you're someone who works in law enforcement. And so they identify so strongly with the institution that to go after the institution itself is to go after them. And that's kind of what I've run into.
Well, I completely agree, and it reminds me of a conversation I was having with a writer friend years ago. So we were both saying that in terms of being revolutionaries, writers are inherently cowards because, you know, we sit and write as opposed to, you know, do something. And you know, there's a certain irony in there, you know, because a lot of times intellectuals are killed in open dictatorships. But nonetheless, you know, we were both saying that writers are cowards. We're both writers. And it's like neither one of us was taking it personally. We weren't saying, Jim, this means you personally are a coward. Derek, this means you personally are a coward. We were making a general comment about writers. The whole taking it personally thing has always struck me as a bit odd. And
yeah.
It's the same, you know, we can talk about how there is white privilege, and we can talk about how, you know, white people have done all these horrible things and are continuing to do them, but that doesn't make me mad.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what that is, that people have that attachment. I feel the same way. When I read your work, and when I read the work of, like, Tim Wise, and you brought up white privilege, I felt like it set me free on some levels. And other people take it as a direct threat, and they feel, you know, guilt, or, you know, they feel challenged.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we've just very nicely addressed the first of my two questions, which was why do you believe people resist so strongly the logic and evidence you present? And I think it's because they're taking it personally, and that they're actually feeling as if their identity is threatened, because it is. And I know from personal experience how challenging that can be, because I killed the Buddha when I moved here and I left active service at the university. I mean, my entire identity was suddenly thrown into the bonfire, and I had to change how I perceived myself, and much less how other people perceive me. So my second question that I would like you to address is how do you deal with the pushback, with the resistance to your message, both personally and professionally? And especially, how do you maintain a professional demeanor while dealing with it? Because I have a hard time with that.
I'm laughing because there have been times when I have not maintained a professional demeanor.
Oh, we feel better now.
Telling somebody to F off is not particularly a professional demeanor, I think.
I've been doing it wrong.
I think that I've gone through phases where when I did it first, when I would get the term I use a lot of times for what actually happens is not that people are actually engaging with the materials themselves, but instead they are shadow boxing. You know, they're boxing their own projections of what I say, because I'm not actually saying what they're saying. I've had people go, oh, my God, you can't take away our hope. Our hope is so important. And, you know, I'm destroying all things that are beautiful in the world when I talk about hope. But it's like, no, actually, I'm very specific that Hope is a longing for a condition, a future condition over which you have no agency. And if you honestly have no agency, I have no problem with having hope. I mean, there are things that are out of my control that I hope. I mean, I hope that once industrial civilization is gone, that all the feedback loops that you described so eloquently, I hope that with the primary insult gone, that there is at least some chance that grasses and prairies and forests can sequester carbon fast enough to keep this planet from turning into Venus, you know? And that part is completely beyond my control. Or I hope that if, let's pretend there wasn't global warming for a moment, you know, salmon are getting hammered anyway, and if it would be ridiculous to say we hope that salmon continue to survive without actually doing anything to help them. But if you remove all the dams, then you have to hope that the salmon will do what they do, because that's beyond your control. So my point is that when people attack me for talking about hope, they're usually attacking the wrong thing, and this happens all the time. What I used to, at the start of my career, when people would write me notes attacking me for something, I would generally try to engage with them on a reasonable level. I would address their concerns. But what I found is that every time I would address some of the concerns, more would come up. And then I would address those, and more would come up, until eventually they would end up cursing me. And what I realized is that oftentimes the – okay, I'm going to back up. I was dating somebody years and years ago, decades ago, who was picking fights all the time. And I didn't understand why she was always picking fights until one day I went to teach in the evening, and I had chickens and dogs at the time, and I forgot to it was after dark, and I never fed the dogs during the day because the chickens would eat the food. So I left to go to teach in the evening, and I forgot to feed the dogs before I left. And so when I got home, it was late at night, and they had chewed up a bunch of boxes and scattered that all over. And I realized, okay, if I was hungry and annoyed and I couldn't express it in English, that I would chew up boxes. You know, the dogs were mad at me, so that's why they chewed up the boxes. And so I realized that this person I was dating was, if I wanted to break up with somebody and couldn't do it, one thing I might do is pick a bunch of fights. So I realized that she was not able to break up, but instead she was picking fights left and right. And that was the real meta message. And I've realized this is, you know, central to a lot of my work is the notion that you can't always trust rhetoric, and you can't always trust, in fact, you quite often can't. You know, the Nazis had themselves convinced that they were doing a good thing and not a bad thing. And as people destroy the earth, they have themselves convinced they're developing natural resources. You know, as Robert J. Lifton's talked about, before you can commit any atrocity, you have to convince yourself that you actually have a claim to virtue, that you're doing a good thing. And that one of the things that I think really central to all my work is the belief that a lot of our discourse consists of rationalizing pre-existing positions and pre-existing prejudices. And most of our philosophy consists of rationalizing, for example, human supremacism. Or in capitalism, any capitalist theory consists of rationalizing the exploitation that is capitalism. And those have an underlying urge. And so what I realized pretty early on in dealing with people who were upset with my work was that a lot of times it was an emotional reaction, and when I attempted to address the actual content of what they were saying, it always ended up with them cursing me. So then that was the first stage, is when I would address it directly. The second stage was after a couple years of doing this, I basically cut to the chase and handled it extremely unprofessionally, where they would send me, you know, a note that was on the surface it was okay, but beneath it, I knew where it was going to end, and I would just cut to the chase and say, you know, get lost. And that was not professional at all. And these days, honestly, I don't usually respond to them at all because I know where it's going to end. And I want to separate this from actual honest-to-goodness critiques. I was doing a talk one time somewhere in the Midwest, and it's Canada, I think. And we're sitting around the table beforehand, and this one guy says, I have a question about Endgame. And he said, the question is, you know, you define cities as places that import resources. And What about an anthill? Doesn't it import resources into its city, into what you could consider a city? And, of course, it destroys the land right there. But ants are actually necessary to the entire community. What is the difference between an anthill and a city? And I said to him, you did it. You have asked me the question that I have dreaded getting for years. Because I still think my analysis is right on, but I couldn't walk my way through. And so I wasn't mad at him at all. It was like, this is and we talked about it for like the next half hour, 45 minutes. And I don't remember what we came up with, but we were able to come up with some things that are the same and things that are different. I didn't mind at all because he actually was asking a substantive question that was not based on his emotional fear based around the work. Is this making sense what I'm saying?
It makes total sense because when I heard Alan Watts on YouTube ask the question, how do we leave the world alone, I came to the same place. I didn't know where to go with that. I didn't, you know, what does that mean as far as the paradigm, you know, we all live in? It makes total sense to me.
This is Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're pleased to have Derek Jensen as our interviewee today. Now, Derek, you frequently write and speak about the perception of separation between humans and nature, particularly since civilizations arose. I write and speak about one of the consequences of this separation, abrupt climate change. Do you have any thoughts about where we're at and where we're headed with respect to abrupt climate change or any of the other outcomes of industrial civilization?
Well, I don't actually, if it's okay to sort of turn this format around, there's a question I've always wanted to ask you, which is it's sort of the question that I brought up earlier, that what is the best case scenario that you see, best remotely realistic case in terms of the temperature of the planet, presuming that either industrial civilization stops or humans go extinct, whichever you want to talk about, what would be the realistic best case in terms of the Earth? The thing I said earlier about prairies sequestering carbon, et cetera. What I'm hoping that you don't take away whatever tiny bit of hope I have, hope in this case, I have for the future of the planet. But if you do, then I may have to just swear at you.
I've never received that sort of treatment before. People swearing at me? Inconceivable. No, I think that the best case scenario is we that the Earth will experience a global average temperature rise of only 5 or 6 degrees centigrade in a decade or two, and will stabilize there before some negative feedbacks kick in. And the planet has stabilized at 5 or 6 degrees above where we're at now, and 11 or 12 degrees above where we're at now, many times in the past, and then something that we don't understand has kicked in terms of negative feedbacks or self-reinforcing feedback loops that lead to a cooler planet. So I think the best case scenario is that we stop at 5 or 6 degrees C in a decade or two. And I don't see any way for large mammals, certainly not humans, to survive that just because of lack of habitat. But, you know, that's happened before. 55 million years ago, according to a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, there was a 5 C temperature rise in only 13 years. And that actually was a minor extinction event. That was not one of the great extinction events, like the 6th that we're in now. And so it's possible, it's completely plausible, in fact, that we'll stop at 5 C above where we're at now and stabilize there for tens of thousands of years and then revert to something that is more conducive to organisms like ours. But even if we don't get down to that point again, there's no reason to think that we can kill every non-human species on the planet. That's clearly one of the goals of industrial civilization, but I just don't see us getting there in the time that's going to take before humans aren't here to cause that sort of extinction event.
Well, thanks. And what was your question to me in the first place?
Oh, there was a question in there.
Yeah, you asked the question, then I turned it back on you.
Right.
Yeah, you keep fucking us up.
My question is, what are your thoughts about where we're headed as a species as a result of industrial civilization?
Well, I think on the it's like a friend of mine, John Osborne, always says, and like so many people say, if we keep going where we're going, we're going to get where we're going. And where we're headed is, you know, as we've said, every single biological indicator is the wrong direction. And still, you know, one of the things that makes me feel worse than almost anything else are off-road vehicles, because I live in this beautiful place in Northern California, and in a beautiful area just with all the redwoods, and it's incredibly reactionary. It's basically Mississippi on the North Coast, and we have a lot of fights over off-road vehicle access to various parts of the forest. And what off-road vehicle access is basically go-karts for adults. And we are actually fighting over toys for adults. And this is not a necessity of life. This is not food, clothing, and shelter. This is not even a reasonable luxury. It's like they're also fighting here because there are some, I live right on the coast too, and there have been some big fights going on in town because there are a couple of beaches that the jet skiers are really fighting very hard to open up to them. And it's the same deal that we're fighting over this stuff. Or there's this new thing in Idaho, or I guess it's not a new thing, but where they are taking jet skis and using the jet skis to make waves, which then people surf on. And this is incredibly destructive to both they do this near the shore because that's where you can make the biggest waves. And it's, of course, incredibly destructive to anybody along the shoreline. And the Fish and Wildlife and everybody else was against it. And so the governor basically made a declaration or something saying that they couldn't stop it. And it's like, that's the level at which we are fighting this. Or, you know, with all the information that is out there and has been out there since, what, 1830 or something about global warming, then, you know, they're still continuing to drill, baby, drill. I don't see how. And then the loyal opposition to that is not actually questioning industrialization itself, but the loyal opposition is saying, well, everything would be fine if we just make these massive solar photovoltaic plants. And that, of course, is incredibly destructive on every other level. And I keep thinking about this line by Robert Coombs, which is, unquestioned beliefs are the real authorities of any culture. And that's one of the things that just keeps us going, is there's this unquestioned belief. I don't understand. I understood when I was in second grade, when I saw a subdivision go in on all these meadows near where I lived, I understood that you couldn't have infinite growth on a finite planet. I remember in second grade thinking, if they keep building, there will be no place for the meadowlarks to live. And if they keep building, they will run out of space eventually. You can't do this forever. And this is one of the things that just breaks my heart about all of this, is that I understood that. I couldn't articulate it, of course, but I understood this in second grade. And I don't understand how anybody who is older than 7 years old could still believe in infinite growth on a finite planet. It's just completely nuts. So that's the thing, is that one of the central things of my entire analysis that sets it apart from a lot of environmental stuff is I don't think, and of course you are right in the same line, that with agreeing with me, I believe, that, I mean, it seems very clear, that the problems we face are not fundamentally rational. The problems we face are nuts. The problems we face is a deep, deep problematical insanity. And that doesn't mean that it doesn't make sense inside the construct. There's a great line about Hitler. It was said by Robert J. Lifton that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. And the point is that once you get people to accept completely insane premises, you know, you can lead them wherever you want. Once you've got the bad logic in place with the bad premises, then everything else can follow. And so what you got to do is you got to go back to those premises. And this whole culture is so completely insane. There can be no greater insanity than destroying the planet that you live on. My voice is getting thin and reedy here because even after 20-some books, I still can't actually believe the depth of the insanity. I can't. There's so often I still think that this is just a bad dream, that nobody could be stupid enough to actually kill the planet they live on. And, you know, we can argue about the word kill, but that's not what's important right now. They could, let's just, to go with the other language, it's just that they could kill the ability of the planet to support their own life. That level of suicidality, I mean, it's very clear from the culture that that's where it's going, but I can't, after 20-some books, I still can't make sense of it.
And maybe it goes back to your point, you know, where you talk about separation, we talked about that a little earlier, is that people have just, they've clearly confused their wants and their needs. They clearly think their needs are their wants. And it seems to me, at some level, for lack of a better word, that we're pursuing to get rid of the boredom in our lives because we no longer are attached to anything that is real.
You know, I'm so glad you said that because that's something I've thought. I've never written about this explicitly, but it's something I've thought for a long time, and I've just never figured out how to write it, that I think part of the reason that the world's being killed is because people are bored, and they want to do something, and it's not good enough to be sitting there, you know, sitting by a pond having a nice time, so they get bored, and so and there's more to it than this, obviously, but I know so many people who, it's like, well, you know, why did you cut down the trees behind your house? Well, I was bored and I wanted something to do, so went out and did it. And it's like, wow, you know, when I'm bored, I read a book or something. I
don't do that.
And there's another thing I wanted to mention that I haven't, I've said a few times, but I don't know if you all know about this, that a book I've been wanting to write for quite a while, and I will probably write, it'll be one of my next books, next couple, three books, it's a novel. And it's about it starts off with the conceit that there are these people, terrorists, who send a note to the government that says, you know, you're obviously going to kill everybody else or a lot of people on the planet, a lot of non-humans on the planet, and it's going to kill yourself. So we have been working for many years. We have developed a virus that is going to basically kill off humans. And if you don't reduce carbon emissions by 80% within the next year, we're going to release it. And, of course, the feds don't believe them. They think this person is crazy. But then they show it's true in some way. And then the government, and here's the part of the point, the government responds not by trying to reduce carbon emissions but by trying to find them, which is actually quite reasonable. And then 6 months go by, and there's been no work toward reducing carbon emissions. So the terrorists decide they're going to go public with this, and they send out notes to, like, every newspaper saying, you got 6 months to reduce carbon emissions or we're going to release this and kills everybody. And here's the point of the novel. The point of the novel is going to be at that point, they completely misjudge, or kind of stupid actually, they completely misjudge the American public because the American public at that point does not clamor for reduction of emissions by 80%. The American public clamors, catch these people under any circumstances. We will do strip searches before we go to the grocery store, take away every civil right we've got. And the point is that, the whole point of the novel, maybe I shouldn't even write the novel now, the whole point of the novel is going to be that people will do anything, including facing their own imminent death, in order to keep this system going. That's how deep their loyalty is to the system, that they would rather the system keeps going, than that they, they would rather the system keep going for another 6 months, and then they die of some disease, than to actually even question stopping the system. And you can see where this dovetails with your analysis of just, even faced with human extinction within a generation, that people will still not question the system at all. I'm just moving the time scale up to a year.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Right, absolutely. As nearly as I can tell, the word sustainability means sustaining the status quo rather than sustaining life on Earth. It's absolutely absurd.
Well, thanks for saying that, too, because I've grown to really hate a lot of the sustainability movement. And you'd think that we would love it because it should be about sustaining the Earth. But so much of it, exactly what you said, I did a talk a couple days ago here in Crescent City, and I don't mind the permaculture movement. I said I hate the sustainability movement, and a couple of permaculture people got really offended. And it's like, no, I'm not actually talking about you. Local food sustainability, that's completely cool. You know, that's great. That's really important, actually. What I'm talking about is sort of a large-scale sustainability TM, which is, you know, I wrote this essay not very long ago about when did the environmental movement become not about protecting wild places and wild beings, but instead becoming about sustaining this horrible culture for a little bit longer. There's been a terrible, do you want to call it a coup? I don't know what we want to call it, a co-optation that environmentalism has long since, for the most part, become not about what it was when I started, where it was all just people trying desperately to protect this hillside, this river, this stream, and instead it's become all about so-called renewables, which are not renewable at all.
Right, as Corey Morningstar pointed out, to start us off there. We're on the verge of needing to wrap up here, so if you in 3 minutes you can tell us what you're working on now. I know you have a monthly article in Orion, and I suspect you're writing a book or two, and you've described a novel just now. So can you fill us in on what else is going on in the world of Derek Jensen that we can look forward to in the coming years?
Well, in a year from now, it's set for to come out next spring. I've got a book that I just finished maybe a month or two ago on human supremacism, which I think is the one of the biggest problems the world faces. That's part of the root of this is this belief that humans are separate from and superior to everybody else. And almost all of the means by which we judge that humans are superior are tautological, in that we will come up with something that humans do, declare that's a means that's how you know that someone is superior. And then what do you know? We are actually superior. And most of them are either nonsense or simply not true. Anyway, a great example, very short, is that they say humans are intelligent because we have big brains. And it's like, well, actually there's creatures with a lot bigger brains than we have. And, you know, whales and walruses have brains almost as big as we do. But it's like, oh, no, the important thing is brain size to body mass ratio. Well, the problem with that is humans have a brain size to body mass ratio of about 2.5%, which is about the same as it is for mice. And migratory songbirds have larger. The largest brain size to body mass ratio that I know of, in the animal kingdom at least, is shrews at about 10%. So it's so funny to just throw this stuff out and see the human supremacists. Then they will just say, well, obviously, brain size to body mass ratio is not the important thing. It's a moving target. As soon as you come up with, or like plants are amazing. There are these people who are, human people, who are developing dictionaries of plant languages because plants speak through using chemical signals. Instead of speaking like we do, they send out chemical signals that say, hey, some caterpillars are chewing on me. You might want to prepare your leaves for when the caterpillars get there. And they send this out to different plants. It's really cool. So that book is about just trying to undercut all of our notion of how we are fundamentally superior and separate and just recognize that everybody has intelligence. Everybody is, and all these intelligences are vastly different. They think completely different things, and it's just absurd to think that we're the only, it's like there's this, I know we got to wrap up, this last thing I'll say. There's this astronomer once, I heard him say, somebody asked him, why do we have to explore Mars? He said, because it'll answer that most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? And that question's nuts. Are we all alone? I mean, I see all these, you're only all alone if you think you're separate from everybody, but we're not. That's the thing is, everybody else, their lives are just as valuable to them as mine is to me. And that's one of the things I really want to get across in all my work.
Well, thank you, Derek, for a great conversation and for your work and really for kind of kicking me in the ass to get out and get out of my teaching career and do something else. So I appreciate your time on the show.
Thank you.
All right.
And thanks for having me, and thank you so much, both of you, for your great work.
Thank you. Well, guys, we have a climate change update this week.
Actually, we have a couple of tidbits worthy of mention. You can find all the details in the often updated essay on the blog. West Antarctica's Larsen B ice shelf is likely to collapse by 2020, according to a NASA-funded study to be published in the June 1st issue of Earth and Planetary Science Letters.
This shelf is the size of France. It is more than 10,000 years old, and it experienced partial collapse in 2002. 2020, by the way, is not very long from now.
No.
and that alone could be responsible for several inches of sea level rise. Now, as we know, sea level rise is not evenly distributed around the planet. So if we get a few inches global average, that means probably on the east coast of the United States, maybe twice that, and certainly enough that with a big storm surge, places like Washington, D.C. will be underwater. That's going to be inconvenient. Following right behind, the Larsen C ice shelf is poised to join Larsen A and Larsen B in collapsing, according to an article in the May 13th issue of the Cryosphere. The catchphrase here, as we've come to expect, faster than expected.
Well, football season will start in August. Everything will be okay.
Alexis from Alexandria brings us our final bit of Breaking Hopium. Take it away, Alexis.
This week in Cognitive Dissonance, I was treated to a 10-minute rant by a father who was celebrating the births of his 5- and 7-year-old sons by meditating on human extinction. I kid you not. So after meticulously outlining our climate predicament and our lack of political capital to address the problem, as well as our role as willing accomplices in the death cult of global capitalism, he wistfully considered the fate of his children, presuming that it was a problem for their lifetimes and not his, then summed it all up by saying that there was actually hope in extinction. Because other species have gone extinct before. I don't know. Happy birthday, boys. Mommy and Daddy got you a dead planet.
All right. On that note, and that's excellent, by the way, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Aggressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show. Please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon. If you missed the show, you can make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and make sure to rate us on iTunes. Thanks again for all the contributions this week from Forrest, Corey, and Alexis, as well as our guest Derek Jensen and Aphrodite for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you.